friend. "But surely you must see the irony of the situation. I was a slave, my life subject to the whim of others. For all my training and advancement in station, I find that this fact has not been altered." He paused for a moment, and his smile was friendly. "Still, I would rather have you hold my life in your hands than my former overseer. That is what I find so funny." Hocho Pepper was startled by the answer. Then he, too, started to laugh. "Many of our brothers pay little heed to the ancient teachings. But if you are familiar with our older philosophers, you will understand my meaning. You seem to be a man who has found his wall. I think we have an understanding, my barbaric friend. I think we have started well." Melamba studied Hocho Pepper. Without knowing the unconscious process whereby he reached the conclusion, he judged he had found an ally, and perhaps a friend. "I think so, as well. And I think you also a man who has found his wall." Feigning modesty, Hocho Pepper said, "I am but a simple man, too much a slave to pleasures of the flesh to have reached such a state of perfect centering." With a sigh, he leaned forward and began to speak intently. "Listen to me well, Melamba. For all the reasons enumerated before, you are as much a weapon to be feared as a possible source of knowledge. Surani are slaves to politics, as any student of the game of the council can attest. While we of the assembly are reputed to be above such things, we have our own factions and infighting, not always settled in a peaceful, bloodless manner. Many of our brothers are little more than superstitious peasants, distrusting that which is alien and unknown. From this day forward, you must bend yourself to one task. Stay peacefully hidden within your wall and become Surani. To all outward appearances, you must become more Surani than anyone else in the assembly. Is that understood?"
"It is," Melamba said simply.
Hocho Pepper poured another cup of hot chocha each. "Be especially wary of the warlord's pets, Elgahar and Aguran, and a reckless youngster named Tapek. Their master rankles at the progress of the war upon your former homeworld and is suspicious of the assembly. Now that two of our brothers died in the last major campaign, fewer of our brothers are willing to lend further aid to that undertaking. The few magicians left within his faction are overtaxed, and it is rumored he will be unable to subdue any more of your world without a miracle. It would take a united High Council, which should happen when the Thune raiders become agriculturalists and poets, and not before, or a large number of black robes agreeing to do his bidding. The latter should occur about a year after the former, so you can see he is in a somewhat poor political situation. Warlords who fail in conducting war tend to fall from grace quickly." With a smile he added, "Of course, we of the assembly are far above matters political." His tone turned serious once more. "You must face one thing. He may view you as a potential threat, either influencing others not to aid him, or openly opposing him from some deep-rooted sympathy for your former homeland. You are protected from his direct actions, but you still might run afoul of his pets. Some still blindly follow his lead. The path of power is a path of turns within turns," Melamba quoted. Hocho Pepper nodded, a satisfied expression upon his face. His eyes seemed to glint. "That is Surani. You learn quickly." In the following weeks, Melamba grew into the fullness of his new position, learning the responsibilities of his office. It was remarked on more than once,
and occasionally with distrust, that there had been few who had demonstrated so much ability so soon after donning the black robe. For all the changes in his existence, Malamba discovered many things were unchanged. With practice, he discovered he still had untapped wells of power within, which could be called up only in times of stress. He studied to bring this wild augmentation of power under control, but with little success. He also discovered he was able to put aside the mental conditions placed upon him during training. He chose not to reveal this fact to anyone, not even Hochopepa. His reordering of these mental conditionings also regained him something else, a nearly overwhelming desire to be with Katala once again. He put aside that desire, to go to her at once and demand her release from the Lord of the Shinzawe. Well within his ability, now he was a great one. He hesitated for fear of the reaction of the other magicians, and for fear her feelings might have changed toward him. Instead, he plunged into his studies. His time in the assembly brought forth his true identity, as he had been told it would. This identity proved the key to his unusual mastery of the greater path. He was a being of both worlds, worlds bound together by the Great Rift. And for as long as those worlds stayed bound together, he drew power from both, twice the power available to others of the Black Robe. This knowledge revealed his true name, that name which could not be spoken lest it let another gain power over him. In the ancient Surani language, unused since the time of the escape, it meant one who stands between worlds. Chapter 5. Voyage. Martin watched. Motioning silently to his companions, they slipped through the woodline, just out of sight of those in the meadow. They could easily hear the shouts in the Surani camp as orders were given. Martin crouched low, so no hint of movement would betray their presence. Behind him scurried Garrett and the former Surani slave, Charles. In the 6 years since the siege of Cridy, Charles had met Martin's expectations, proving his loyalty and worth a dozen times. He had also become a passable woodsman, though he would never have Garrett or Martin's natural ease. Whispering, Charles said,
"Huntmaster, I mark many new banners."
"Where?"
Charles pointed to a spot near the farthest edge of the Surani camp. With the aid of the dwarves remaining in the high villages, Martin and his two companions had made the dangerous climb over the grey towers, easily passing the few Surani sentries left along the western edge of the valley, the flank thought least in need of vigilance. Now they were within a few hundred feet of the main Surani camp. Garrett let forth a nearly silent whistle.
"The man has eyes like a falcon. I can barely see those banners."
Charles said,
"I only know what to look for."
"What do the new banners mean?"
asked Longbow.
"Ill news, Huntmaster. Those are the house banners of families that were loyal to the Blue Wheel Party. At least when I was captured. They have been absent since the siege of Cridy. This can mean only another major shift in the High Council."
He studied the Huntmaster's face.
"It tells us the Alliance for War is again restored, and next spring we can expect a major offensive."
Martin motioned for them to move back into the woods. The trees were fully covered in fall colours, riots of red, gold, and brown. Moving quietly through fallen leaves, they found a sheltering stand of brush skirting an ancient oak and knelt behind it. Martin took out a small piece of dried beef and chewed it. The climb over the grey towers, even with the dwarves' help, had taken its toll. They all were hungry, tired, and dirty. Where are the new companies of soldiers? Martin asked.
They won't bring them through this winter. They can stage outside the city of the plains on Keliwan, at ease in a milder climate. They move through the rift just before the spring thaw. By the time flowers are blooming in Princess Carleen's garden again, they'll be marching.
A high-pitched keening sound came from the north. Charles's expression changed to one of controlled alarm.
Chocha!
He glanced around, then pointed upward. Martin nodded and made a stirrup with his hands. He boosted first Charles, then Garrett, into the oak tree. Then he jumped, and they caught his hands and pulled him up. Moving into the higher branches, they were motionless and had weapons ready when the Chocha patrol came into view, passing beneath the tree. Six of the ant-like creatures moved at a steady pace. Then the leader, marked by a crested helm of Surani make, motioned them to halt. He turned one way, then another, then made commands in their high-pitched language. The other five spread out, and for nearly 10 minutes the three men in the tree could hear them searching the area. When they returned, they quickly formed up and moved off. When Martin was certain they were out of hearing range, he whispered,
"What was that?" "They smelled us. My scent will have changed from all the Midkemian food I have eaten. They knew we were not Surani."
Climbing down from the tree, Charles said,
"Chocha cannot look easily upward, so they rarely do."
Garrett asked, "What if some of your former countrymen had been along?" Charles shrugged.
"The Chocha would have been speaking Surani. Their language is almost impossible to learn, so no one tries."
Martin said,
"Will they be able to mark our trail?"
Charles said,
"I don't think so, but..."
He stopped as loud barking came from the Surani camp.
"Dogs!"
Martin said, "They can track us. Come." He set out at a controlled run, back toward an ancient trail into the mountains, one almost completely overgrown and undiscovered by the Surani, but used by Martin's band to enter the valley. For a few moments the three men loped through the woods, listening to the barking behind. Then the sound of the dogs changed, and barks became howls and baying.
"They've gotten the scent," said Garrett.
Martin only nodded and picked up the pace. They ran for another minute, the sound of the dogs steadily gaining on them, when Martin halted and grabbed at Garrett's arm to keep him from running past. With a signal, he changed directions away from the trail and led the others to a small stream. Entering the water, he said,
"I remembered hearing this when we passed by before."
The other two entered the water, and Martin said,
"We gain only minutes. They'll search up and downstream."
Garrett said,
"Which way?"
Martin said, "Downstream. They'll search upstream first, as that's the way out."
Charles said,
"Huntmaster, there's another way."
He quickly unshouldered his backpack and removed a large pouch. He began sprinkling black powder up and down the shore of the stream where they had entered. Garrett felt his eyes tearing and blew hard through his nose to keep from sneezing.
"Pepper!"
Charles said,
"Master Cook Meager will be angry, but I thought we might need it. The Chocha and the dogs will smell nothing for hours when they sniff around here."
Martin nodded.
"Upstream!"
The three men splashed through the water, then got into a quieter, steady rhythm. They were out of sight of the place where they entered when the baying of the dogs was interrupted by sneezes. Angry voices shouted commands, and frustrated replies were heard. Charles indulged himself in a faint smile as they continued to move through the water. Finding a branch low enough over the stream, Martin boosted his companions out and climbed up after them. They moved along the tree until they found another branch of a nearby oak close enough to jump to. They touched the ground again, a dozen yards from the stream bank. Martin glanced around to ensure they were not seen and motioned for the others to follow as he led them back toward the grey towers. Sea breezes swept the walls. Arutha looked out at the town of Crydee and the sea beyond, his brown hair ruffled by the wind. Patches of light and dark flashed across the landscape as high, fluffy clouds raced overhead. Arutha watched the distant horizon, taking in the vista of the endless sea whipped to a froth of whitecaps, as the noise of workmen restoring another building in the town blew by on the wind. Another autumn visited Crydee, the eighth since the start of the war. Arutha considered it fortunate another spring and summer had passed without a major Surani offensive. Still, he felt little cause for comfort. He was no longer a boy fresh to command, but a seasoned soldier. At 27 years, he had seen more conflict and had made more decisions than most men of the kingdom knew in their lives. In his best judgment, he knew the Surani were slowly winning the war. He let his mind drift a little, then shook himself out of his brooding. While no longer a moody boy, he still tended to let introspection overtake him. He found it best to keep busy and avoid such wasteful pastimes. It is a short autumn. Arutha looked to his left and found Roland standing nearby. The squire had caught the prince lost in thought and had made his approach without detection. Arutha found himself irritated. He shrugged it off and said, "And a short winter will follow, Roland. And in the spring, what news of Longbow?" Arutha balled a gloved fist and gently struck the stones of the wall, the slow, controlled gesture, a clear sign of his frustration. "I've regretted the need for his going 100 times. Of the three, only Garrett shows any sense of caution. That Charles is a Surani madman, consumed by honor, and Longbow is... Longbow," finished Roland. "I've never met a man who reveals so little of himself, Roland. If I live as long as an elf, I don't think I'll ever understand what makes him the way he is." Roland leaned against the cool stones of the wall and said, "Do you think they're safe?" Arutha returned his attention to the sea. "If any man in Crydee can crest the mountains into the Surani-held valley and get back, it is Martin. Still, I worry." Roland found the admission surprising. Like Martin, Arutha was not a man to reveal what he felt. Sensing the prince's deep trouble, Roland changed the topic. "I've a message from my father, Arutha." "I was told there was a personal message among the dispatches from Tulan." "Then you know father's calling me home." "Yes. I'm sorry about the broken leg." "Father was never much of a rider. It's the second time he's fallen from his horse and broken something. Last time, when I was little, it was his arm." "It's been a long time since you were home." Roland shrugged. "With the war, I felt little need to return. Most of the fighting's been around here. And," he added with a grin, "there are other reasons to stay." Sharing the smile, Arutha said, "Have you told Carleen yet?" Roland lost his grin. "Not yet. I thought I'd wait until I'd arrange for a ship south." With the Brotherhood's abandonment of the Green Heart, travel by land to the south was nearly impossible, for the Surani had cut off the roads to Kars and Tulan. A shout from the tower caused them to turn. "Trackers approaching!" Arutha squinted against the glare reflecting off the distant sea and could make out 3 figures trotting easily along the road. When they were close enough to be seen clearly, Arutha said, "Longbow!" There was a note of relief in his voice. Leaving the wall, Arutha descended the steps to the courtyard to wait for the huntmaster and his men. Roland stood by his side as the 3 dusty men entered the gates of the castle. Both Garrett and Charles remained silent as Martin said,
"Greetings, Highness."
"Greetings, Martin. What news?" asked the prince. Martin began to recount the facts unearthed at the Serrani camp, and after a moment Arutha cut him off. "Better save your wind for the council, Martin. Roland, go gather Father Tully, Swordmaster Fannin, and Amos Trask, and bring them to the council hall." Roland hurried off, and Arutha said, "Charles and Garrett are to come as well, Martin." Garrett glanced at the former Serrani slave, who shrugged. Both knew the long-anticipated hot meal would have to wait a little longer upon the prince's convenience. Martin took the seat next to Amos Trask, while Charles and Garrett remained standing. The former sea captain nodded a greeting to Martin as Arutha pulled out his own chair, as was his habit, ignoring most formalities when with his counselors. Amos had become an unofficial member of Arutha's staff since the siege of the castle. He was an enterprising man of many unexpected skills. Fannin sat to Arutha's right. Since his wound, he had been content to accept Arutha as commander in Crydee and had sent a personal note to Lord Borick advising him so. The Duke had sent a reply ratifying the transfer of command, and Fannin had returned to his former role as adjutant. The Swordmaster seemed pleased with the situation. Arutha said, "Martin has just returned from a mission of special importance. Martin, tell us what you've seen." Martin said, "We climbed the Grey Towers and entered the valley where the Serrani have their headquarters." Fannin and Tully looked at the Huntmaster with surprise, while Amos Trask guffawed.
"You toss aside a small saga in one sentence," said the seaman.
Martin ignored the comment and said,
"I think it best to let Charles tell you what we saw."
The former Serrani slave's voice held a note of concern.
"From all signs, the warlord will launch another major offensive next spring."
Everyone in the room sat speechless, save Fannin.
"How can you be sure? Are there new armies in his camp?"
Charles shook his head.
"No, the new soldiers will not arrive until just before the first spring thaw. My former countrymen have little liking for your cold climate. They will stage during the winter months on my former homeworld. They'll move through the rift just before the offensive."
Even after 5 years, Fannin still had lingering doubts about Charles's loyalty, though Longbow held none.
"How, then," said the Swordmaster, "can you be certain there is to be an offensive? We've had none since the assault on Elvander 3 years ago." "There are new banners in the warlord's camp, Swordmaster. The banners of the houses who belong to the Blue Wheel Party. They have been absent for 6 years. It can mean only another major change within the High Council. The Alliance for War is again formed."
Of those in the room, only Tully seemed to grasp what Charles was saying. He had made a study of the Serrani, learning all he could from the captured slaves. He said,
"You had better explain, Charles."
Charles took a moment to organize his remarks and said,
"You must understand one thing of my former homeland. Above everything except honor and obedience to the Emperor, there is the High Council. To gain in the High Council is worth much, even the risk of life itself. More than one family has been destroyed by plots and intrigues within the council. We of the Empire refer to this as the Game of the Council. My family was well placed within the Hunzan clan, neither great enough to warrant notice by our clan's rivals, nor small enough to be relegated to only minor roles. We had the benefit of knowing much of the matters before the High Council without having to worry overly much about what decisions were made. Our clan was active in the Party for Progress, for we numbered many scholars, teachers, healers, priests, and artists in our families. Then, for a time, the Hunzen clan left the Party for Progress, for reasons not clear to any but the highest family leaders, reasons I can only speculate on. My clan joined with the clans of the Blue Wheel Party, one of the oldest in the High Council. While not so powerful as the Warlord's War Party, or the traditionalists of the Imperial Party, it still has much honor and influence. 6 years ago, when I first came here, the Blue Wheel Party had joined with the War Party to form the Alliance for War. Those of us in the lesser families were not told why such a radical change in alignment had come about. But there was no doubt it was a matter of the game of the Council. My personal fall from grace and my enslavement were certainly necessary to ensure that those of my clan would stay above suspicion until the time was ripe for whatever move was being planned. It is now clear what that move was. Since the siege of this castle, I have seen no sign of any soldier who's a member of the Blue Wheel families. I took it to mean the Alliance for War had been ended.
Fanon interrupted. Are you then saying the conduct of this war is but an aspect of some political game in this High Council?
Charles said, Swordmaster, I know it is difficult for a man as steadfast in his loyalty to his nation as you are to understand such a thing. But that is exactly what I am saying. There are reasons, Surani reasons, for such a war. Your world is rich in metals, metals we treasure on Kelly-1. Also, ours is a bloody history, and all who are not of Suranuani are to be feared and subjugated. If we could find your world, then might you not someday find ours? But more, it is a way for the warlord to gain great influence in the High Council. For centuries we have fought the Thuril Confederation, and when we at last were forced to the treaty table, the War Party lost a great deal of power within the Council. This war is a way for that lost power to be regained. The Emperor rarely commands, leaving the Warlord supreme, but the Warlord is still the lord of a family, the War Chief of a clan, and as such is constantly seeking to gain advantage for his own people in the game of the Council.
Tully looked fascinated. So the Blue Wheel Party joining with the Warlord's Party, then suddenly withdrawing, was but a ploy in this political game, a maneuver to gain some advantage?
Charles smiled.
It is very Surani, good father. The Warlord planned his first campaign with great care. Then, 3 years into it, finds himself with only half an army. He is overextended, unable to bring news of smashing victories to the High Council and the Emperor. He loses position and prestige in the game.
Fanon said,
Unbelievable. Hundreds of men dying for such a thing. Such is the way of the game of the Council, Swordmaster. The Warlord Almicho is an ambitious man. To be Warlord, one must be. He must rely on other ambitious men, many who would seek to take his mantle should he falter. To keep these men as allies rather than foemen, he must occasionally look the other way. In the first year of the war, the Warlord's sub-commander, a man called Taseo of the Min Wanabi, ordered an attack upon one of the Lamushan garrisons. Besides being second in command in the campaign on this world, Taseo is also the cousin of Lord Jingu of the Minwanabi. The order to attack was given to Lord Sisu of the Akoma, sworn enemy of Jingu. The Akoma soldiers were almost destroyed to a man, including Lord Sisu and his son. Taseo arrived moments too late to save the Akoma, but in time to seize the battle and bring the warlord a victory.
Fanon's eyes were round with disbelief. That's the blackest duplicity I have ever heard of. Erutha said, It's also brilliant by these people's standards.
Charles nodded in agreement with the prince's remark.
The warlord would forgive Taseo getting one of his better commanders slaughtered and losing the entire Akoma army in exchange for a victory and strengthened support by the Minwanabi. Any ruling lord who had no direct stake in the game would applaud the move as a masterstroke, even those who admired Lord Sisu. It gained Almicho and Lord Jingu many allies in the council. So the warlord's political opponents, needing to devise a way to counter his growing power, created the situation I described, overextending the warlord and leaving him unable to prosecute this war. Many families hovering near the edge of the war party would then be drawn to the Blue Wheel and their allies for delivering such a stunning blow.
Erutha said, But the important fact for us is that this Blue Wheel is once more allied with the warlord, and their soldiers will be rejoining the war come spring.
Charles looked at those in the council hall.
I cannot begin to guess why there has once again been a realignment in the council. I am too removed from the game. But as His Highness has said, what is important for those of us here in Crydee to know is that as many as 10,000 fresh soldiers may come against one of the fronts in the spring.
Amos scowled.
That's a backbreaker for certain.
Erutha unfolded a half dozen parchments. Over the last few months, most of you have read these messages. He looked at Tully and Fanon. You've seen the pattern begin to emerge. He picked up one parchment. From Father, constant Serrani sorties and raids keep our men in a state of unease. Our inability to close with the enemy has lent a dark aspect to all we do. I fear we shall never see an end to this business. From Baron Bellamy, increased Serrani activity near the Jonril garrison. I deem it advisable to increase our commitment there this winter, while the Serrani are normally inactive, lest we lose that position next spring. Squire Roland will be supervising a joint reinforcement from Kars and Tulan at Jonril this winter. Several in the room glanced at Roland, who stood near Arutha's shoulder. The prince continued. From Lord Dulanic, Knight Marshal of Krondor. While His Highness shares your concern, there is little to indicate the need for alarm. Unless some intelligence can be produced to give credence to your fears of possible future Serrani offensives, I have advised the Prince of Krondor to refuse your request for elements of the Krondorian garrison to be sent to the far coast. Erutha looked around the room. Now the pattern is clear. Setting aside the parchments, Erutha pointed at the map affixed to the tabletop. We have committed every available soldier. We dare not pull men from the south for fear of the Serrani moving against Jonril. With the garrison strengthened, we will have a stable situation down there for a while. Should the enemy attack the garrison, it can be reinforced from Kars and Tulan. Should the enemy move against either castle, they leave Jonril at their back. But all that will fail should we strip those garrisons. And Father is committed to a long front and has no men to spare. He looked at Charles. Where would you expect the attack to come?
The former Serrani slave looked over the map, then shrugged.
It's difficult to say, Highness. Should the situation be decided solely upon military merits, the warlord should attack against the weaker front, either toward the elves or here. But little done in the Empire is free of political considerations.
He studied troop dispositions on the map, then said,
Were I the warlord, in need of a simple victory to bolster my position in the High Council, I would attack Crydee once more. But were I the warlord and my position in the High Council precarious, in need of a bold stroke to regain lost prestige, I might risk an all-out offensive against the main force of the kingdom, those armies under Duke Boric's command. To crush the main strength of the kingdom would give him dominance within the council for years to come.
Fanon leaned back in his chair and sighed.
Then we are faced with the possibility of another assault upon Crydee this spring without recourse to reinforcements for fear of attack elsewhere.
He indicated the map with a sweep of his hand.
Now we face the same problem as the Duke. All our forces are committed along the Surani front. The only men we have available are those in the towns on leave, only a small part of the whole. We can't maintain the army in the field indefinitely. Even Lords Boric and Brucall winter in the mutt with the Earl, leaving small companies to guard the Surani.
Waving his hand in the air, he said,
I digress. What is important is to notify your father at once, Sir Uther, of the possibility of attack. Then, should the Surani hit his lines, he'll be back from the mutt early, in position and ready. Even should the Surani bring 10,000 fresh troops, he can call up more soldiers from the outlying garrisons in Yaban, fully another 2,000.
Amos said,
2,000 against 10,000 sounds poor odds, Swordmaster.
Fanon was inclined to agree.
We do all we can. There are no guarantees it will be enough.
Charles said,
At least they will be horse soldiers, Swordmaster. My former comrades still have little liking for horses.
Fanon nodded agreement.
But even so, it is a bleak picture.
There is one thing, said Arutha, holding up a parchment. The message from Lord de Lannock stated the need for intelligence to give credence to our request for aid. We now have enough intelligence to satisfy him, I think. Fanon said,
Even a small portion of the Crondorian garrison here would give us the strength to resist an offensive.
Still, it is late in the season, and a message would have to be dispatched at once.
That's the God's truth, said Amos. If you left this afternoon, you'd barely clear the Straits of Darkness before winter shuts them off. In another 2 weeks, it'd be a close thing.
Arutha said, I have given the matter some thought. I think there is enough need to risk my going to Crondor. Fanon sat up straight in his chair.
But you're the commander of the Duchy's army, Arutha. You can't abandon that responsibility.
Arutha smiled. I can, and I will. I know you have no wish to resume command here once more, but resume command you will. If we are to win support from Erland, I must convince him myself. When Father first carried word of the Surani to Erland and the king, I learned the advantage of speaking in person. Erland's a cautious man. I will need every persuasion I can bring to bear. Amos snorted.
And how do you plan on reaching Crondor, begging your Highness's pardon? There's the better part of 3 Surani armies between here and the Free Cities, should you go overland. And there are only a few luggers fit for coasting in the harbour, and you'd need a deep water ship for a sea journey.
There's one deep water ship, Amos. The Wind of Dawn is still in port.
Amos's mouth dropped open.
The Wind of Dawn?
He cried in disbelief.
Beside the fact she's little better than a lugger herself, she's laid up for the winter. I heard her captain crying over her broken keelson when the muddle-headed fool came limping into harbour a month ago. She needs to be hauled out, have the keel inspected and the keelson replaced. Without repair, her keel's too weak to take the pounding she'll get from the winter storms. You might as well stick your head in a rain barrel, begging your Highness's pardon. You'd still drown, but you'd save a lot of other people a great deal of trouble.
Fannin looked incensed at the seaman's remarks, but Tully, Martin, Roland, and Arutha only looked amused. When I sent Martin out, said Arutha, I considered the possibility I might need a ship for Krondor. I ordered her repaired 2 weeks ago. There's a swarm of shipwrights aboard her now. He fixed Amos with a questioning look.
Of course, I've been told it won't be as good a job as if they'd hauled her out, but it will serve. Aye, for potting up and down the coast in the light winds of spring, perhaps. But you're talking about winter storms, and you're talking about running the Straits of Darkness.
Arutha said, Well, she will have to do. I'm leaving in a few days' time. Someone must convince Erland we need aid, and I have to be the one. Amos refused to let the subject drop.
And has Oscar Dantine agreed to captain his ship through the straits for you?
Arutha said, I've not told him our destination as yet. Amos shook his head.
As I thought, that man's got the heart of a shark, which is to say none. And the courage of a jellyfish, which is also to say none. Soon as you give the order, he'll cut your throat, drop you over the side, winter with the pirates of the Sunset Islands, then head straight for the Free Cities come spring. He'll then have some Natalie scribe pen a most grieving and flowery message to your father, describing your valour just before you were lost overboard in high seas while fighting pirates. Then he'll spend a year drinking up the gold you gave him for passage.
Arutha said, But I purchased his ship. I'm ship's master now. Amos said,
Owner or not, prince or not, aboard ship there is but one master, the captain. He is king and high priest, and no man tells him what to do. Save when a harbour pilot's aboard, and then only with respect. No, Highness, you'll not survive this journey with Oscar Dantine on the quarter-deck.
Faint lines of mirth began to crinkle at the corners of Arutha's eyes. Have you another suggestion, Captain? Amos sighed as he sank back into his chair.
I've been hooked. I might as well be gutted and cleaned. Send word to Dantine to clear out the captain's cabin and discharge the crew. I'll see to getting a replacement crew for that band of cutthroats, though there's mostly drunkards and boys left in port this time of year. And for the love of the gods, don't mention to anyone where we're bound. If so much as one of those drink-besotted scoundrels learns you mean to risk the Straits of Darkness this late in the season, you'll have to turn out the garrison to comb the woods for deserters.
Arutha said, Very well. I'll leave all preparations to you. We depart as soon as you judge the ship ready. He said to Longbow, I'll want you to come as well, Huntmaster. Longbow looked a little surprised.
Me, Highness?
I'll want an eyewitness for Lord Dulannock and the Prince. Martin frowned, but after a moment said,
I've never been to Krondor, Highness.
He smiled his crooked smile.
I may never have the chance again.
Amos Trask's voice cut through the shriek of the wind. Gusts from the sea carried his words to a confused-looking lad aloft.
No, you warped-brained landlubber! Don't pull the sheet so damn tight. They'd be humming like a lute string. They don't pull the ship. The mast does. The lines help when the wind changes quarter.
He watched as the boy adjusted the sheets.
Yes, that's it. No, that's too loose.
He swore loudly.
Now, there you have it.
He looked disgusted as Arutha came up the gangway.
Fishing boys who want to be sailors, and drunkards, and a few of Dantine's rogues I had to rehire. This is some crew, Highness.
Will they serve?
They bloody well better, or they'll answer to me.
He watched with a critical eye as the sailors crawled over the spars aloft, checking every knot and splice, every line and sheet.
We need 30 good men. I can count on 8. The rest, I mean to put into casks as well as to land on the way down. Maybe then we can replace the boys and less dependable men with experienced seamen.
What of the delay clearing the straits?
If we were there today, we would manage. By the time we get there, a dependable crew will prove more important than arriving a week earlier. The season will be full upon us.
He studied Arutha.
Do you know why the passage is called the Straits of Darkness?
Arutha shrugged. Amos said,
It's no simple sailor's superstition. It's a description of what you find there.
He got a far-off look as he said,
Now, I can tell you about the different currents from the endless sea and bitter sea that come together there, or about the changing crazy tides of winter when the moons are all in the worst possible aspect in the heavens, or how winds come sweeping down from the north, blowing snow so thick you can't see the decks from the yards. But then, there are no words to describe the straits in winter. It is 1, 2, 3 days travelling blind, and if the prevailing wind's not blowing you back into the endless sea, then it's blowing you to the southern rocks. Or there's no wind, and fog blots out everything as the currents turn you around.
You paint a bleak picture, Captain, said Arutha with a grim smile.
Only the truth. You're a young man of uncommonly practical wits and cold nerve, Highness. I've seen you stand when many men of greater experience would have broken and run. I'm not trying to put any scare upon you. I simply wish you to understand what you propose to do. If any can clear the straits in winter in this bucket, it is Amos Trask, and that's no idle boast. I've cut the season so fine before, there's little to tell between autumn and winter, winter and spring. But I would also tell you this. Before leaving Crydee, say tender goodbyes to your sister. Write your father and brother, and leave any testaments and legacies in order.
Without changing expression, Arutha said, The letters and legacies are written. And Carleen and I dine alone tonight. Amos nodded.
We'll leave on the morning tide. This ship's a slab-sided, wattle-bottomed, water-rotted coaster, Highness. But she'll make it through if I have to pick her up and carry her.
Arutha took his leave, and when he was out of sight, Amos turned his attention heavenward.
Astolon!
He invoked the god of justice.
I'm a sinner, it's true. But if you had to measure out justice, did it have to be this?
Now at peace with his fate, Amos returned to the business of seeing everything in order. Carleen walked in the garden, the withering blooms reflecting her own sad mood. Roland watched her from a short way off, trying to find words of comfort. Finally, he said, I will be Baron of Tulan some day. It is over 9 years since I've been home. I must go down the coast with Arutha. Softly, she said, I know. He saw the resignation on her face and crossed to hold her.
You will be Baroness there some day, also.
She hugged him tightly, then stepped away, forcing herself to speak lightly. Still, you'd think after all these years your father would have learned to do without you. He smiled.
He was to have wintered in Jonrel with Baron Bellamy, overseeing the enlargement of the garrison. I will go in his stead. My brothers are all too young. With a Surani dug in for the winter, it is our only chance to expand the fort.
With forced levity, she said, At least I won't have to worry about your breaking the hearts of the ladies of your father's court.
He laughed. Little chance of that. Supplies and men are already assembling, and the barges ready to travel up the river Windermere. After Amos puts me ashore into land, I'll spend one or two days at home. No more, then off I go. It will be a long winter in Jonrel, with no one for company but soldiers and a few farmers in that God's forsaken fort.
Carline covered her mouth as she giggled. I hope your father doesn't discover you've gambled away his barony to the soldiers come spring. Roland smiled at her.
I'll miss you.
Carline took his hands in hers.
And I you.
They stood in tableau for a time. Then suddenly Carline's facade of bravery cracked, and she was in his arms.
Don't let anything happen. I couldn't bear losing you.
I know,
he said gently. But you must continue to put on a brave face for others.
Fannin will need your help in conducting court, and you will have the responsibility for the entire household. You are mistress of Crydee, and many people will depend upon your guidance.
They watched the banners on the wall snapping in the late afternoon wind. The air was harsh, and he drew his cloak about them. Trembling, she said,
Come back to me, Roland.
Softly, he said,
I'll come back, Carline.
He tried to shake a cold, icy feeling that had risen within, but could not. They stood on the dock in the darkness of morning before the sunrise. Arutha and Roland waited by the gangway. Arutha said,
Take care of everything, Swordmaster.
Fannin stood with his hand upon his sword, still proud and erect despite advancing years.
I will, Highness.
With a slight smile, Arutha said, And when Gaudin and Algon return from patrol, instruct them to take care of you. Fannin's eyes blazed as he shot back.
Insolent pup! I can best any man of the castle, save your father. Step down from the gangway and draw your sword, and I'll show you why I still wear the badge of Swordmaster.
Arutha held his hands up in mock supplication.
Fannin, it is good to see such sparks again. Crydee is well protected by her Swordmaster.
Fannin stepped forward and placed his hand upon Arutha's shoulder.
Take care, Arutha. You are always my best student. I should hate to lose you.
Arutha smiled fondly at his old teacher.
My thanks, Fannin.
Then his manner turned wry.
I would hate to lose me also. I'll be back. And I'll have Erland's soldiers with me.
Arutha and Roland sprang up the gangway, while those on the dock waved goodbye. Martin Longbow waited at the rail, watching as the gangway was removed and the men upon the quay cast off lines. Amos Trask shouted orders, and sails were lowered from the yards. Slowly the ship moved away from the quayside into the harbour. Arutha watched silently, with Roland and Martin beside, as the docks fell behind. Roland said,
I was glad the princess chose not to come. One more goodbye would be more than I could manage.
I understand, said Arutha. She cares for you greatly, Squire, though I can't see why.
Roland looked to see if the prince was joking and found Arutha smiling faintly. I've not spoken of it, the prince continued. But since we may not see each other for some time after you leave us in Tulan, you should know that when the opportunity comes for you to speak to father, you'll have my word on your behalf.
Thank you, Arutha.
The town slipped by in darkness, replaced by the causeway to the lighthouse. The false dawn pierced the gloom slightly, casting everything into greys and blacks. Then, after some time, the large, upthrust form of the Guardian Rocks appeared off the starboard quarter. Amos ordered the helm put over, and they turned southwestward, more sail set to bring them full before the wind. The ship picked up speed, and Arutha could hear gulls crying overhead. Suddenly he was struck with the knowledge they were now out of Kreide. He felt chilled and gathered his cloak tightly around him. Arutha stood on the quarter-deck, sword held ready, Martin to one side notching an arrow to his bowstring. Amos Trask and his first mate Vasco also had weapons drawn. Six angry-looking seamen were assembled upon the deck below, while the rest of the crew watched the confrontation. One sailor shouted from the deck,
"You've lied to us, Captain! You've not put back north of Kreide as you said into Tulan! Unless you mean for us to sail on to Keshin Ilariel, there's nothing south save the straits. Do you mean to pass the Straits of Darkness?"
Amos roared,
"Damn you, man! Do you question my orders?" "Aye, Captain. Tradition holds there's no valid compact between captain and crew to sail the straits in winter, save by agreement. You lied to us, and we're not obliged to sail with you."
Arutha heard Amos mutter,
"A bloody sea lawyer."
To the sailor he said,
"Very well,"
and handed his cutlass to Vasco. Descending the ladder to the main deck, he approached the seaman with a friendly smile upon his face.
"Look, lads,"
he began as he reached the six recalcitrant sailors, all holding belaying pins or marlin spikes.
"I'll be honest with you. The prince must reach Krondor, or they'll be held to pay come spring. The Serrani gather a large force which may come against Kreide."
He placed his hand upon the shoulder of the sailor's spokesman and said,
"So what it comes down to is this. We must sail to Krondor."
With a sudden motion, Amos had his arm around the man's neck. He ran to the side of the ship and heaved the helpless sailor over.
"If you don't wish to come along," he shouted, "you can swim back to Tulan."
Another sailor started to move toward Amos when an arrow struck the deck at his feet. He looked up and saw Martin taking a bead upon him. The huntmaster said,
"I wouldn't."
The man dropped his marlin spike and stepped back. Amos turned to face the sailors.
"By the time I reach the quarter deck, you had better be in the rigging, or over the side. It makes no difference to me. Any man not working will be hanged for the mutinous dog he is."
The faint cries for help of the man in the water could be heard as Amos returned to the quarter-deck. To Vasco he said,
"Toss that fool a rope, and if he doesn't relent, pitch him overboard again."
Amos shouted,
"Set all sails! Make for the Straits of Darkness!"
Arutha blinked seawater out of his eyes and held on to the guide rope with all the strength he possessed. Another wave crashed over the side of the ship, and he was blinded once more. Strong hands grabbed him from behind, and in the darkness he heard Martin's voice.
"Are you all right?"
Spitting water, he shouted,
"Yes!"
and continued to make his way toward the quarter-deck, Martin close behind. The wind of dawn pitched and rolled beneath his feet, and he slipped twice before he reached the ladder. The entire ship had been rigged with safety lines, for in the rough sea it was impossible to keep a footing without something to hang on to. Arutha pulled himself up the ladder to the quarter-deck and stumbled as much as walked to Amos Trask. The captain waited beside the helmsman, lending his weight to the large tiller when needed. He stood as if rooted to the wood of the deck, feet wide apart, weight shifting with each move of the ship, his eyes peering into the gloom above. He watched, listened, each sense tuned to the ship's rhythm. Arutha knew he had not slept for 2 days and a night, and most of this night as well.
"How much longer?"
Arutha shouted.
"One, 2 days, who can say?"
A snap from above sounded like cracking spring ice upon the River Cridy.
"Hard aport!"
Amos shouted, leaning heavily into the tiller. When the ship heeled, he shouted to Arutha,
"Another day of these God's cursed winds buffeting this ship, and we'll be lucky if we can turn and run back to Tulan."
They were 9 days out of Tulan, the last three spent in the storm. The ship had been relentlessly pounded by waves and wind, and Amos had been in the hold 3 times, inspecting the repairs to the keelson. Amos judged them due west of the straits, but